Hi, this is Anna from Vancouver, Canada. This is embarrassing to ask. How can I avoid incontinence as I enter menopause? Am I experiencing vaginal atrophy? How do I prevent fecal incontinence?
Welcome to our Perimenopause What the F podcast, brought to you by the Peri community. In this podcast, we talk everything, and we mean everything, perimenopause. We navigate through all our what the F perimenopause moments and all is this normal questions. We talk with perimenopause experts, thought leaders, and inspirational voices of the community. To connect with other perimenopause warriors, download our free Peri app. You can find the link in our show notes. And now let's dive right in.
My name is Dr. Rena Malik. I'm here with Dr. Sarah Reardon, who will introduce herself as well. We are excited to be here on behalf of Peri to discuss your questions about perimenopause. This is such a wonderful community, and we are so, so happy to have you here. Education is power, and that's why we're here. I am a urologist and pelvic surgeon by training. I take care of both men and women with sexual dysfunction, hormonal dysfunction, pelvic pain, and bladder issues. And so we're going to talk a little bit about some of those things today, and I'll let Dr. Sarah Reardon introduce herself as well.
Before we move on, I want Dr. Malik to tell us where she is on social media, because she's got some pretty amazing presence on YouTube. And so share it, because I feel like people will find that so helpful because they'll want to learn more.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm Rena Malik, MD, on all social media platforms. I make content on all of them. My biggest platform is YouTube, where you can find videos about sexual health, urologic health, and so much more. I've got about 1.8 million subscribers there. And so I think you'll find that useful. And I also have a new podcast, which I'm working on. And if you guys find podcasting interesting, that's a great place to follow me as well.
I'm Dr. Sarah Reardon. I am a pelvic floor physical therapist. So I'm a board certified pelvic health specialist for 17 years. I practice in New Orleans, Louisiana, but I have an online platform called The Vagina Whisperer. That's also where you can find me on social media, on Instagram and TikTok, where I just really share a lot about pelvic health. So everything from incontinence to pregnancy, postpartum, perimenopause and menopause. And just really my goal is to start having the conversations that we've been having behind closed doors for so long, so that we can really offer women the support that they need and deserve. I'm super excited to be here with Dr. Malik today to start answering your questions on behalf of Peri. So let's just jump right into some of the questions that we were sent in from the Peri community. So I'm going to ask Dr. Malik the first one. So first question is, how to best avoid urinary tract infections, also known as UTIs, as they are more frequent in perimenopause?
So this is a great question. I see so many women who suffer from recurrent urinary tract infections. So they're getting 3 or more infections in a year, 2 or more in 6 months. You know, as soon as they start going into menopause, perimenopause, they start noticing they're getting more and more UTIs. And the reason for this is the vaginal pH actually changes. So there's a change in estrogen. Your estrogen drops, which then makes you make less lactobacilli in the vagina and changes the pH. And so your pH actually goes up. And because of this, the bacteria are more likely to stick around and actually get into the bladder. And so it's actually a really challenging time for a lot of people. Now, some things you can do, the most effective thing is using vaginal estrogen. So vaginal estrogen is extremely safe. There has never been a reported blood clot, breast cancer, uterine cancer, anything from vaginal estrogen, because it is local, meaning it's just affecting those tissues, very, very minimal amounts into the bloodstream. And so it's extremely safe, and it really helps one, basically normalize the health of that tissue and bring that pH down so that you can now prevent UTIs. And this is something you can take from when you start having issues till death do you part. Like, you never have to stop it. It's extremely safe. It's just like we take care of our skin, right? We're so good about putting on all our serums and whatever. The same thing, you got to take care of your vagina. And so you have to put these things on to help. Now, if you have a contraindication to vaginal estrogen, there's a whole bunch of other things in general that you can do to prevent UTIs. The most important thing is drinking fluids. So we've looked at studies that have shown that if you drink 2 to 3 liters of water a day, you'll reduce your incidence of UTIs. And fluids doesn't have to be water, but you'll reduce your incidence of UTIs by 46%. percent. So it's really powerful drinking more fluids. And it's hard, I get it. But now we have all these like cups with straws that tend to make people drink a little more, and you can carry them around all day and they can help with that. Now, being careful that if you have other bladder issues like overactive bladder, it might make that worse. But ultimately, preventing UTIs usually becomes the number one priority. Now, the other important thing I want people to know is you are not dirty. Like, this is not because you're not hygienic, there's something going on with you. These UTIs happen because of microbiome changes or things that we're not exactly sure why. And it's not because you're dirty. In fact, you're cleaning so much sometimes that you're actually irritating the skin and causing symptoms that are not UTIs. So if you're having recurrent UTIs, it's super important to get evaluated by a urologist or your primary doctor to make sure there's no other cause. Like, is there a kidney stone or something else that keeps causing these infections? And once you've ruled that out, then there's these whole host of things you can do, like drinking more fluids, avoiding constipation. So a lot of people don't know this, but when you're constipated, you're more likely to get UTIs because one, it may affect your bladder function, but two, all that bacteria from the stool will actually be more likely to get into the bladder. So avoiding constipation can be helpful. And then there's certain things like cranberries, actually in the American Urological Association guidelines. Now, not the cranberry juice that is like full of sugar. That's not going to help you. But cranberry supplements with 36 milligrams of proanthocyanidines has been shown to be beneficial in preventing recurrent UTIs. Now, those are sort of the things I start with. And then we sort of work our way down. And of course, like I said, always making sure that you are evaluated to make sure there's no other source for those infections that we can correct.
This is so much amazing information. One of the things I wanted to add is I love the fact that you mentioned hydration, because I think oftentimes when people are perimenopausal or menopausal, they may leak urine and they may have a lot of urinary urgency and frequency. So that tends to encourage people to drink less water because they're thinking, oh, if I drink less water, then I'll go to the bathroom less frequently. But what actually happens, your urine gets more concentrated and then you're at a higher risk for urinary tract infection. So I think it sounds a little bit counterintuitive, but it actually is you want to hydrate because it's going to dilute your urine more.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that brings us to our next question, which was like, okay, so we know that bladder leakage or bladder issues are more common as you enter menopause. So how can women avoid incontinence as they enter menopause? And, you know, there's obviously changes in the vagina. There's some thinning of the vaginal tissues called atrophy. And sometimes there's even stool leakage. So what can people do to help prevent those issues?
So I think that, you know, a lot of us are just learning that there are muscles in this area called the pelvic floor muscles. And I have my trusty little model here to show everyone. So at the very base of your pelvis is a basket of muscles. And these muscles help support your pelvic organs. And they have the opening to the urethra, the vaginal opening, and the anal opening. So these are just like any other muscles in your body. But with aging, there's a couple things that happen. Dr. Malik mentioned that there are estrogen changes. So estrogen is a hormone that really plumps up the vulvar and vaginal tissue. With decreasing estrogen supply with aging and into perimenopause, those tissues tend to get a little bit thinner and less supportive, and that can lead to an increased risk of urinary leakage, which is also called incontinence. Other things are we get muscle atrophy. So just like every other muscle in our body can get weaker, studies show that you lose 2% of your pelvic floor muscle strength every year after the age of 35, which totally sucks. So that means we
2%,
do have to be-
That's really a lot.
It's a lot. And so it's 2% of the urethral strength of those muscles. And so it's one of those things that we have to be proactive about learning how to properly strengthen this muscle and turn it on when we need it. So the most common way that people have heard of is Kegel exercises. So I feel like from the age of 17, reading Cosmo magazine, I've been hearing about Kegel exercises. And those are just contractions of these muscles. So it's a little bit of a squeezing the urinary sphincter, like you're stopping urine or holding in gas and lifting up those muscles. However, you're not going to strengthen these muscles just, you know, doing Kegel contractions at the red light. You really want to work this muscle in different positions. So maybe in sitting, but also in standing or while walking, and then turning the muscle on when you need it, before a cough, before a sneeze, and even when you're exercising. You know, we recommend doing a lot of resistance exercises into perimenopause and menopause to strengthen our overall skeletal health and muscles. But you need to turn that pelvic floor muscle on to strengthen it and engage it when you're loading it. So it's, you know, also doing quick contractions, which is just a squeeze and relax, a squeeze and relax, but then also doing longer holds. So squeezing and holding for 5 to 10 seconds and then completely relaxing. You have two different types of muscle fibers. One's like a sprint muscle fiber, and that's the one that turns on before a cough or a sneeze. And then you have marathon muscle fibers that can engage and help you close that sphincter so you can get to the bathroom in enough time when you've got a full bladder. And you really want to work both. So quick contractions, longer hold contractions, doing these exercises, you know, different times throughout the day, but also in different positions, and then making sure that you're doing it properly. There was research done that showed that 40% of people who were just given a brochure on how to do Kegels weren't actually doing the right exercise. And half of those were doing the opposite, which could make their symptoms of leakage worse. So checking in with a pelvic health therapist, I've got some videos on my platform that kind of show you how to check to make sure you're doing a Kegel contraction properly, but really kind of learning how to work this muscle that we're just learning about to strengthen. And then as Dr. Malik recommended, you know, I typically refer out to a urologist or a gynecologist to help someone supplement with topical estrogen. I really do feel like this is essential to help pump up those vulvar and vaginal tissues, which are also going to help with incontinence. With respect to fecal incontinence, that's loss of poop, that can also help, you know, occur with aging. It's more common actually in people who have had a more severe perineal tear during childbirth, so a grade 3 or 4, which goes into the rectal muscles or the anal sphincter. And again, that's a strengthening issue. But one of the things you want to think about is keeping your poop bulky. So the softer your stool is, the harder it is to keep it in. So I don't want it like, you know, super hard and firm like rabbit pellets, but somewhere in between. I tell people it should look like soft serve at TCBY. Like you want a nice smooth ring coming out. If it's too soft, it's like those muscles are trying to hold up applesauce versus holding up something more solid like peanut butter. So
like the poop emoji.
Right, right. So you want to eat, you know, a banana, a potato, more white grains, something to kind of bulk it up, and avoid foods like greasy foods or a lot of processed foods or alcohol, acidic things, things that can make your stool a little bit more runny. So these are, you know, such good questions and really common. I think many more people experience these than we realize. So, and, you know, I just talked a little bit about topical estrogen. I think that this is something we're hearing so much about. So I'd love to hear from you, Dr. Malik, like when should we start topical estrogen? So tell us a little bit about like what that protocol looks like. Do we do it before we start having symptoms or after? And then specifically to help with bladder problems.
Yeah. So before I get into that, I just want to add to your topic. One, I would say that absolutely see a pelvic floor physical therapist if you have access to them, because like Dr. Reardon mentioned, a lot of times we don't know how to do Kegels and we're not doing them correctly. And so if you have access and the time, it is a great resource to help with learning, not just Kegels. There's more to it than just Kegels. And so like, I think people are like, oh, that's all I have to do. But like, sometimes it's like getting your pelvis in alignment or like making sure everything else is functioning appropriately and your core coordinated. So there are sort of many steps to it. So if you can see a pelvic floor physical therapist, that can be really, really powerful. And then also if you're doing these things and you're still struggling, please see a urologist or a gynecologist or even your primary doctor, because honestly, there's so many things we have to offer from the side of helping you in terms of reducing both urinary and fecal incontinence, or even just overactive bladder symptoms, which are like urgency, frequency, urgency, incontinence. And so like, don't suffer. Don't suffer at home. I will see so many women who will wait like 10, 15, 20 years struggling with leakage. And they're like, oh, I just didn't get around to it. I was too busy taking care of my kids. I was too busy doing X, Y, Z, you know, working. But like, this helps your confidence. It helps you feel good. It allows you to do the things you want to do without worrying about pads or other things. And so if you are struggling and it's bothering you, please don't delay, you know, like just make the time. You're worth the time to do that for yourself. The last thing I will add is for the stool, fiber helps. So if you can eat anything with more fiber or just take like fiber gummies or fiber pills with a lot of fluid, that will help bulk up your stools if you're having fecal leakage. And so that can be really helpful. And with urinary incontinence, depending on the type of incontinence, there's a whole host of things we can do. But again, like I said, just don't struggle. Don't struggle in silence. Do the exercises, work on them, learn the exercises, get help, and you can definitely live a life that you want. To answer your question about when to start vaginal estrogen. So for me personally, I plan to start it as soon as I start noticing any perimenopausal symptoms. I'm going to start it and continue till death do me part. But some people will need it like when they're lactating because they notice that their tissues are really dry, their estrogen levels are low. And so they're breastfeeding like, man, it hurts when I have sex. And this is going to help with that. So for me personally, just because I know so much about vaginal estrogen, I'm very convinced about the safety. I would start it as soon as I notice any sort of bothersome symptoms because it's preventative in my mind. But that's not technically what it's meant for. It's meant for symptoms, right? So if you're having dryness or discomfort, if you're having recurrent UTIs, if you're having urinary urgency, like gotta go, going a lot to the bathroom, if you're having leakage, like gotta go, and then you have an accident, if you're having pain with sex, those things are absolute indications to start. And don't give up right away. One, knowing that it can take 3 months before you see a benefit in your symptoms. So like stick with it. And two, if you don't like a formulation, like you think the cream is messy or you don't like the suppository, like go back to your doctor and get it switched. There's so many options available. And say you're like sensitive to a cream, you can get it compounded with something, you know, that's less sensitive. So there's a whole bunch of options and generally it's pretty affordable. So you can actually get a coupon for GoodRx to get estrogen creams pretty affordably. So like, even if your insurance doesn't cover it, like it is totally manageable to get access to it and to use it. And ideally it should be over the counter, but that's like a whole other story for another day.
So two questions that come up that I think that folks may have are, who do they go to get it? Do they go see a urologist specifically? Should they start with their gynecologist? I feel like it's tricky for a lot of my patients to be like, well, who do I see? Because they'll see their gynecologist. Like, I feel like a lot of us are having babies later in life and then we're breastfeeding for a few years. And then all of a sudden we're in perimenopause, which is myself. And so that being the case, it's like, who do you see? Because you can see your gynecologist and they're like, oh, I don't really manage perimenopause. So who is the person that we should really start seeing? Can you let people know?
So ideally, anyone can prescribe vaginal estrogen. So you can start by just asking your doctor, right? Ask your primary doctor, ask your gynecologist, ask the doctors you already have in your life, because you might be surprised. They may be like, sure, like I'm happy to prescribe it. Like we are spreading gospel all over the country about how safe vaginal estrogen is. So we've had ER doctors prescribe vaginal estrogen now, you know? And so you never know. But if they're saying, I don't feel comfortable, then find a urologist who is. So usually someone who is interested in female pelvic medicine and reconstructive surgery or urogynecology, or find a sexual medicine doctor, usually who deals with women, those sorts of people, and gynecologists also who are trained in urogynecology, those people will be very comfortable prescribing vaginal estrogen. And so really a good place to start if you're struggling. But like I said, ask your primary, like they may feel comfortable enough prescribing it and you may avoid having to like go through all these steps because, you know, it's not always easy to get in to see a specialist depending on where you are. But of course, absolutely, if you're struggling, there are plenty of people you can go on the SUFU.org.com website where you can find a urologist. You can go on the Ishwish website where you can find a doctor. Ishwish, ISSWSH, is the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. SUFU is a really long term, basically for the Society of Urogynecology, Female Pelvic Medicine, Reconstructive Surgery, but it's a different name. So you can like look on those websites and find a provider near you.
And I really love recommending my patients see a urologist. One of the things is I'm like, especially if they're experiencing symptoms of incontinence or prolapse or something like that, because I'm like, I want you to be under the care of someone so they can monitor you. So if we do need to have you go back to fit for something like a pessary, or we need urodynamics testing, or like really kind of having this team of specialists for these different parts of our bodies and seasons of life. So I'm a big fan of kind of like having this, you know, team, and I feel really lucky to be in this field. And I'm like, okay, this is a great urologist in our area who you can kind of go see, who's going to be supportive of your journey. So I think that that's a really important piece. One of the things I will recommend, so I started topical estrogen after stopping breastfeeding, because I definitely felt, I'm a long-term breastfeeder, like, so my kids are like walking up to me and I'm like, all right, buddy, it's time, you know? And so then what I would say is I definitely noticed changes in my tissues. And so, but one of the kind of tactical things I tell people is when they're typically prescribed it, it comes, you get like a little plunger that you have to insert the cream into and then plunge it into the vaginal canal. And they're like, do I keep reusing that? And, or can they apply it with their finger? Will you go a little bit more into a deep dive? Because I feel like that's something people have a lot of questions about and patients come to me about, and I'd love to hear what you tell your patients.
I find the plunger to be a little bit unwieldy. So I tell people, like, take your finger, right, and measure about this much. And everyone's finger, like, I have a long finger, about this much, and put it on your finger, and then just rub it in like lotion. Like, you don't need to like think too hard about it. You don't need to get it all the way up at the top of the vagina. You just need to get it in the vaginal tissues. So not the vulvar tissues, not the skin on the outside. You need to get it into the vaginal tissues. And then particularly if you're getting recurrent UTIs, make sure you get the area around the pee hole or the urethra. So I think just don't overcomplicate it. Don't stress out about it. And if you rub it in, like, it won't be messy. I think whether you use a plunger, it gets a little messy and it gets a little like, you're like, oh, I don't like the way that feels. And so if you rub it in like lotion, it kind of, it just is in there and it's not as bothersome.
Yeah, I recommend the finger too. And also when somebody has vaginal atrophy or tissue dryness or sensitivity, that plunger can be scratchy and itchy and just really uncomfortable to use. So I agree with that totally.
I think you brought up pessaries. So I want to skip to that question because I think it's important to talk about it in terms of what is a pessary and why might someone need one. So can you touch base on that a little bit?
Yeah, and I think you're actually going to have a lot to add too, being a urologist. But so there's actually been, you know, we're now approved as physical therapists to start fitting people for pessaries in the United States and going through different sizes with them. And I don't do that, but I refer out to a urogynecologist and a nurse practitioner in our area who does it. I'm a huge fan of pessary. So a pessary is an internal support for the vaginal walls, and they come in different shapes and sizes. They can be a ring, they can be a cube, but they are meant to kind of offer support to the vaginal walls to better support the pelvic organs. So whether you have a bladder prolapse or a rectal prolapse or a rectocele or a uterine prolapse. So it kind of like, you know, if you have a tent that has walls and there's like a little pitch to it, if that the top of the tent starts to collapse down or the walls start to come in, that's when your pelvic floor muscles or your vaginal walls aren't as supportive as we need them to be and your organs start to press in. So we typically use a pessary to kind of support those vaginal walls and offer mechanical to support to the walls that the vaginal walls and the tissues aren't able to provide at that time. Now, a pessary isn't a one and done thing. So you typically get fit for it by a therapist, urologist, urogynecologist, or a nurse practitioner. You need to try it out. There are different shapes and sizes, and you really have to find out what works best for you. So it's kind of, you know, I've had patients who are like, hey, I tried a pessary, it didn't work. I'm like, well, that's like saying you tried on pants and they didn't fit. Like, try another pair of pants, you know? So you really need to get fit for them. They insert into the vaginal canal and you can wear them either with just activity. You can wear them all the time and take them out every 1 to 2 weeks to clean. Or you can wear them even while you're just practicing your pelvic floor exercises, you know, throughout the day and waiting for your muscles to kind of get a little bit stronger, but you've got some internal mechanical support. I am a huge fan of pessaries because just from a mechanical and muscle perspective, when those muscles aren't providing the support that you need, it's almost like everything is just getting heavy and you'll start having symptoms of heaviness in your pelvis, a bulge in your vagina, not being able to empty when you poop, straining when you pee, urinary leakage. And you might be straining and doing things that are actually making it worse, but giving a pessary just kind of supports those things to help you empty better and to relieve some of those symptoms of heaviness, pressure, even back pain. So there are just a bunch of different ones. There are space occupying ones, depending on the type of prolapse you have. If you have an avulsion tear from childbirth, there's ones that are more specific for that. And there's even over-the-counter ones. And that's usually where I recommend my patients start. There's one called the Revive, which is an internal bladder support. You can get it on Amazon. It's not like a tampon, but it's like a little bit of a medical grade silicone that you plunge into the vagina. It looks like a tampon applicator. And you can wear it all throughout the day. You wear it for up to 12 hours, but it just gives you some internal support of those walls. There's another one called the Poison Prezza that has been out on the market for a long time. It looks like a little parachute that opens up in the vagina. It's a one-time use, however, so I do tell patients that it's not as economical and you will have to go through them more often. But, you know, for some patients, I have them wear it all of the time, depending on their level of activity, if they're standing on their feet a lot, if they're depending on their level of prolapse. And some people I have them only wear it with activity. Like I have a postpartum mom who's a runner and she really only has extreme bladder leakage when she runs really long distances. So she just wears it for that. Or I have a menopausal, you know, woman in her 70s who is hiking in Spain and, you know, in all the trails all over the US. And she wears it when she's hiking and she's got a pretty severe bladder prolapse. One of the things I do tell people is if you're going to do pelvic floor exercises, where the pessary when you're doing them, because I want your muscles and tissues to be in the optimal position when you're exercising them. And the other thing is that people are like, oh, it's just a Band-Aid. I'm like, it's actually not a Band-Aid. It's actually a device a little bit between just conservative exercise and medication management and surgery. So the goal is to really help relieve your symptoms, kind of put your tissues in the optimal position so that they can, you know, tissues can remodel. So having them in a more supported position than kind of being tired and fatigued makes a really big difference. And then also, you know, maybe prolong how long it takes for you to get to surgery if that's an eventual thing that you will need. I think it's a great option. I think a lot of people find them really helpful. But again, there are some therapists who are fitting for them in the U.S., but I more often recommend seeing a urologist or a urogynecologist or nurse practitioner who fits them as well.
I think ultimately people get worried like, oh, am I going to feel it? You're not going to feel it. Like once it's in there, yeah, it feels like putting in a larger tampon, right? When it goes in, you're going to feel it go in, but then you shouldn't feel it like all day. It should just be like, oh, I don't really feel anything. If you're feeling it, that means it's probably too big. So like, again, just getting a right fit and the right type of pessary, and it can take a little bit of trial and error. So usually we book like at least half an hour to just make sure we're getting like the right size and that you get time to walk around in it and feel how it feels and make sure you feel good, that it's not going to fall out and it feels good. So it is really, once it's in, people are like, oh, I don't even feel it. Like it's not as big of a deal as I thought it was going to be. And so I think it's great. It's a great option for people, particularly if they say they're like, maybe you're even on your way to surgery. Like it's just great to feel comfortable, you know, like for a short period to like not feel like something's falling out all the time. So it can be really helpful. You can also use pessaries or the poison pressa for stress incontinence. So when you're leaking with coughing, sneezing, lifting heavy things, you can get special types of pessaries that have a little knob on them that push the urethra or the tube where the urine empties from, that can help reduce that leakage. So while they're traditionally used for prolapse, you can also use them for stress urinary incontinence. And so that can also be pretty helpful for people, particularly when they're like, I just don't have time right now to get anything done. I just don't want to leak all the time. Or like, yeah, you know, you're going to go work out and do like this high intensity workout where you're jumping and doing all these things, and that's the only time you leak. Again, a great time to use it.
Yeah, I love that. And you can have sex with them in, like Dr. Malik mentioned, if it's, you feel it, it's too low. Like you have a lot more sensation at the opening of the vaginal wall and tissues. And so it's likely just too low. And so sometimes it's just placing it and working, you know, go back and see your medical provider. I mean, this is the thing. I have so many people come in, they're like, it's not comfortable, I'm not using it. I'm like, go back. Like it's not a one and done thing. So really kind of keeping those conversations open so that you find something that works for you, because they can be a really great option. So we talked a little bit about prolapse. I think that this is something that feels really scary when people start going down the rabbit hole of Google to learn about it. And so I know that there's a lot of different types of prolapse. And so, you know, studies show that a lot of us have this to some extent. Can you talk a little bit, Dr. Malik, about if somebody has vaginal prolapse? Like you may even want to start with just what is it and what does it mean? But how do you prevent it from getting worse? And is surgery the only option?
Yes, great questions. So I think prolapse in general, just to start from the basics, right? Prolapse is a hernia. It's a vaginal hernia. So it means that the vaginal skin is starting to get lax and behind it, the organs are coming. But what you see is not your bladder. You see your vagina, but the bladder is behind it, or the uterus is behind it, or the rectum is behind it. So when you think about the vagina, it's like a tube, right? And so the top of it can prolapse. That's anterior prolapse. The apex, or like the, so the front of it can prolapse, that's anterior. The top of it can prolapse, that's apical. And there's the posterior, the back can prolapse, and that's posterior. So you can call it different compartments, basically. And any one of those things can happen. And why does it happen? Well, typically when you've had lots of babies, or even one or two, it doesn't really mean lots, but you can have very large babies. You can have a job where you stand all the time and you're kind of constantly fatiguing those muscles. You can have genetic issues, like you may just not have as much collagen content as someone else in their tissues, or you can have neurologic conditions that can cause it. And so there's all these risk factors, being overweight, having a chronic cough. Those things can make it potentially more likely that you're going to get prolapse. But as you mentioned, Dr. Reardon, that prolapse is common. So if we look at studies of women who have some stage of prolapse, it's very, very common. Like I forget the exact number, but it's very, very common for women to have a little bit of prolapse, especially after they've had babies. And so it doesn't matter unless it bothers you. And I think that's the key. Like some people will say, my doctor told me I had a prolapse. What's going on? They've never felt it. It doesn't bother them. They're living their life. They're super happy. Then you don't have to do anything about it. It is not dangerous. It's only really a problem when it bothers you. Now, rarely do you see it becoming a problem where the prolapse is so bad that it's causing issues like with your bladder or your kidneys, because the tubes that drain the kidneys also get stretched. And so that's extremely rare. Most of the time it's like, are you bothered? Are you having other symptoms, which can include difficulty with urination or difficulty with defecation? And again, this, it's sort of complex, but bottom line is like, are you bothered, right? So that's number one. So what can you do to prevent it from happening? Well, doing pelvic floor exercises. So it's just like going to the gym. Those pelvic floor muscles are just like any other muscle in your body, right? When you want to get muscle hypertrophy, you go to the gym and you work out. When you want strength, you go to the gym and you work out. So, but we don't work out our pelvic floor muscles. I mean, sometimes you do without intentionally knowing to, like, orgasms actually cause pelvic floor muscle contraction. So you are, I guess, working out if you're having orgasms, whether they're by yourselves or with a person. But generally speaking, you're not consciously spending time, unless you're doing Kegels, to, you know, get that strength in those muscles. And not just Kegels, like I mentioned, a whole bunch of pelvic floor exercises, but you do need to strengthen those muscles and know how to do that correctly so you don't over-tension them. And we'll talk about that shortly, but so you don't over-tension them, and you make sure you still use them functionally, like you're relaxing those muscles well enough. And so that can be very powerful in terms of preventing prolapse or preventing the progression of it. Now, if you look at the natural progression of prolapse, about 40% of people will remain the same. So you come in to see the doctor because you have prolapse, you do nothing about it because it's not really a huge problem. And 40% of people will remain about the same. Maybe 10 to 20% will get better. And the other little bit will get a little bit worse. And again, it's all about bother. It's all about how much it bothers you. So I would just say the best way to prevent it is to do these exercises, pelvic floor muscle exercises, going to a pelvic floor physical therapist, or check out Dr. Reardon's content online, or, you know, there's a whole host of videos on how to do pelvic floor muscle exercises correctly, safely, and make sure you're doing those regularly can be very powerful. Now, there's no medical treatment for prolapse. So you can't take a pill that's going to go away. We don't have that. But pessaries, we talked about already. And then there is surgical options. And surgery can be vaginal, can be abdominal. And it really depends on which type of prolapse you have and how bad it is. So this is sort of a longer discussion that you would need to have with your doctor. But it's not always a big major surgery that's going to, like, you know, going to be so hard to recover from. It really depends on your individual prolapse. And so I think that, you know, don't get so scared that, like, oh my God, I'm going to have this big surgery, my life is going to change and all this sort of stuff. There's certainly things you can do conservatively. And then ultimately, if you need surgery, you can talk about what kind of surgical options there are. And now even, you know, abdominal surgeries are robotic and recovery is really not as bad as it used to be. So I think ultimately, don't be super scared. If you need it to feel better about your life, like, you can do that. And I always tell people, like, if you're worried, try the pessary first. See how different you feel with your muscles in the right place. And if you feel great, that may be like, okay, you know what? I love my pessary, but I don't want to do it for 20, 30 years. Then maybe I should really consider surgery. But if you love the pessary, keep doing that. There's no mandatory reason to get surgery unless you're bothered or you're in that very, very small population where it's causing, you know, problems with your kidneys or things like that.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think touching on the last point about surgery, oftentimes I have patients come in and they're like, I feel like I failed and I have to have surgery. I'm like, I have had patients come in and it's kind of like if you tore your ACL in your knee. This is how I think about physical therapy. Like, I'll see you before. I'm going to train your muscles. I want to help you rehab them and get them as strong and functional as possible before surgery. We're going to go through like early rehab after surgery. And then you're going to come back to physical therapy and we're going to do strengthening stuff afterwards. So it's really about kind of providing a continuum support for people versus being like, hey, do this one exercise or do this one medicine. Or, you know, it's really kind of looking at it holistically and be like, how can we best support you so that, one, you feel like you can manage this and that you're the driver of your health care instead of feeling all these things are happening to you. But two, how can you also prevent it from getting worse and live the quality of life that you want? I have a very young mom in her 30s who just had a prolapse repair. And we had been through physical therapy for a long time. And it was just to the point where she was like, I'm getting really depressed. I'm feeling like I'm really struggling with doing the exercises. I'm not going to wear a pessary because I know I'm not going to be consistent with it. Like, what do I do? And I was like, well, I think we have to think about the next step. And she's doing amazing. And so we don't hear these stories oftentimes, and we don't even think that it's us who may need it. But I just always am like, explore your options, get a really great team, which is, you know, not always easy. But, you know, feeling like somebody's looking at the big picture. To add to what Dr. Malik said, I think strengthening exercises are obviously excellent. I think so. My kind of three rules of thumb for prolapse are like strengthen, get support. And so whether that means using an internal support, like a poison pressor or a pessary, and there's even some external supports. Like there are these like jock strap type underwear by a company called SRC, or there's one called the pelvic floor press. They're not super sexy, but they get the job done. So sometimes if people need something externally to kind of support those perineal and vulvar tissues, that can give a lot of symptom relief. And the last thing is stop straining. So one of the biggest causes I see of kind of descent of pelvic organ is chronic straining over time, which can happen with coughing or sneezing or a job where you lift a lot, but it's also with straining with constipation. And I talk so much on my social media about how to poop and people are like, why is this pelvic floor related? One of the number one ways you have so much pressure on your pelvic floor is straining with pooping, more than coughing, sneezing, lifting, running, jumping. It's straining with pooping. So if you are having really hard poops and you are not relaxing your pelvic floor muscles well, and even if you have your prolapse repaired, if you continuously strain and hold your breath, whether you're pushing to poop or even, you know, holding your breath to lift, if you're a, you know, CrossFitter or a heavy weightlifter and you're holding your breath, all of that puts so much pressure on your pelvic floor. And we do this day in and day out. So really, you know, using a squatty potty when you're pooping, like Dr. Malik mentioned, keeping your poop super soft with using fiber, or I had people take magnesium citrate, which is like a natural calm is the brand name of it over the counter. It's a couple gummies you can take at night that can keep your poop pretty soft. I'm staying really hydrated. And then, you know, making sure that you're exhaling when you're pooping, not holding your breath to strain. And then also, again, thinking about the things that you're doing day to day. If you're picking up, you know, grandkids, if you're picking up babies, if you're picking up heavy boxes from Costco, like exhale as you do that. You don't want to be holding your breath every time you can feel it. It puts pressure on your pelvic floor. So kind of, I always say exhale with exertion, whether you're giving birth, whether you're lifting a box, whether you're pooping, exhale. And that's really going to minimize the pressure on that pelvic floor over time. And that's going to help with prolapse as well.
Yeah. And when you're weightlifting. So I know a lot of us are doing more resistance training as we know it's better and better for us, particularly as we're heading into perimenopause and menopause. Weightlifting is super important, but make sure you're breathing and you're not holding your breath. I think the other coin of this, right, is pelvic floor tension. And I see so much of this in my practice. And I think it is really under discussed and it is really a huge issue. So maybe Dr. Reardon, you can talk about pelvic floor tension or high tone pelvic floor and what that means and how people can get evaluated or know they have it.
So yeah, we've talked a lot about pelvic floor weakness when things are kind of long and lengthened, then we need to strengthen them and do all of this, you know, Kegels or tightening. But I would agree with you that the majority of the people I see actually have a lot of tension in their muscles. And what that means is your pelvic floor muscles are like any other muscle in your body. They can kind of contract and relax and, you know, get in a normal range. Sometimes they can be weak and then they need a little bit more strengthening, but sometimes they can be tight. And so I get really like a lot of neck and shoulder pain and I start having really bad headaches because I get a lot of muscle tension up here. The same thing can happen in your pelvic floor. And the way that that can present is if you have a hard time starting your urinary stream, or you feel like you have to strain to pee, if you're not able to empty your bowels completely, or you strain with constipation, or you feel like you don't empty completely, if you have painful intercourse, if it's not just a dryness issue or a tissue issue, it can feel like something's hitting a wall, or even you have pain or bruising, like a bruisey sensation with deeper penetration. Or even things like tailbone pain or back pain or hip pain. I mean, when we are in pain, our bodies tighten and tense up and the muscles in this pelvic floor region do the same thing. And Kegels are the opposite of what you'd want to do. So you really want to focus much more on relaxation and lengthening of these muscles. So how do you relax your pelvic floor? If it was that easy to just be like, chill out, we'd be fine, but it's not. Just look at your day-to-day. Are you sitting with your legs crossed a lot? Are you a butt clencher and you feel yourself kind of tightening your butt and holding your breath a lot? You know, are you sleeping with your knees kind of collapsing and curled up in this little ball? Think of the things that you're doing all throughout the day and even exercising a lot. If you're doing a lot of like tightening and strengthening and all of these things where you tighten your core, but then you have to balance that with relaxation and lengthening. And some of the things I recommend are a lot of yoga. So some of my favorite poses that lengthen and relax the pelvic floor are like a child's pose, a deep squat pose. I even have people just like get out of your chair and just kind of squat down to the ground like you're tying your shoe, but it lengthens and relaxes the pelvic floor. Lying on your back and just bring your knees to your chest, kind of nice, relaxed, open knees. Bring your knees to your chest. All of these squatting or positions where you bring your knees to your chest help lengthen the pelvic floor. If we think about, you know, the way we're teaching people to poop is putting their feet on a stool and leaning forward like they're squatting. Or if we think about how, you know, we instruct women to give birth, it's lying on their back and their knees to their chest because it's relaxing the pelvic floor. So those are all things we want to think about during the day. And then breathing, go into your breath, you know. When we are holding our breath, which a lot of us tend to do and we don't even realize when we're anxious or stressed, that tightens our pelvic floor. Your diaphragm is kind of at the top underneath your rib cage and your pelvic floor is at the very bottom. So just taking these big, deep breaths where you inhale and kind of feel the ribs open up and then exhale, relax, can help just relax your pelvic floor throughout the day. I tell people to do it when they're sitting at their desk or they're stuck in traffic, because these are all the times that we're tightening up down there. And if you're having pain, that's not normal. You know, I always say pain with sex isn't normal unless you want it to be. So really checking in with a pelvic health therapist. They do an internal pelvic muscle assessment. So through the vaginal opening, and they like press on the muscles of the wall. So kind of looking at these muscles here, they go in through the vaginal opening and they'll have you contract and relax these muscles like you're doing a Kegel. And you may feel like, gosh, my Kegel's so weak, but actually it just might be so tight. And you're trying to do this to a muscle that's already tight. So we look at how you contract, are you relaxing well? And are those muscles tight or tender when you press on them? And those are typically signs of overactivity or tension where you don't want to strengthen. You focus on relaxation first. And then after we get the muscle nice and relaxed, we can progress to strengthening if needed. And I see this a lot actually with prolapse. If people are straining to pee or poop, it's actually their muscles are so tight that they've been straining and that leads to prolapse. So it's always kind of peeling back the onion to be like, what's the root cause of some of these issues? Is it tension? Is it just weakness? And that's why like blanket Kegels aren't really a prescription for everyone, but we really kind of need to know like which pathway do you need to walk down before we just say, okay, go ahead and do these exercises.
Yes, I love that. I would say a good urologist and gynecologist will also assess your pelvic floor muscles. So that's important. And then the other symptoms that I think I see a lot, and you've touched on most of them, but one is that you're getting recurrent UTIs, but they keep coming back negative. So you're like, I keep getting these UTIs, but like it's not positive. And so the antibiotics aren't helping. Very often it's actually that you have pelvic floor dysfunction. And the way I describe it is like TMJ. So, you know, people clench their jaw at night or grind their teeth and you have no idea, right? You can't control it. Like it's just happening. And you wake up sometimes with headaches or like your teeth hurt or whatever. And your dentist is like, you're grinding your teeth. That is the exact sort of same thing that's happening in the pelvic floor. In fact, there's some studies that show that people who do one are often have the other. And so you're clenching these muscles all the time and they're not relaxing. And so you don't have control over it. So don't feel guilty about it. Don't feel bad about it. Like it's not something you're consciously doing. You don't really realize you're doing it. And so that's super important. So yeah, the recurrent UTIs, pain with sex is another big one. And then the other one is overactivity of the bladder. So very often I'll see women with overactivity, and that's the question we have in the chat about overactivities. They'll have a lot of urge to go, gotta go, gotta go, gotta go. They're going a lot to the bathroom. And the cause is because it can be because of age, but sometimes it's because their pelvic floor is so tight and that the tension of the pelvic floor is then sort of bothering the bladder because the bladder sits right on top of the pelvic floor and making the bladder feel like it needs to go. So it's sort of like, it's very, very beneficial if you're experiencing these issues to get evaluated, to assess your pelvic floor, or even just if you're like, I don't have time, I don't have this or that, start doing some of these yoga exercises. Like I love the happy baby pose. That's my favorite one I tell patients to do. But like whatever it is, like doing these lengthening exercises at home, it's certainly not going to harm you in any way and it may benefit you. But of course, the best thing to do is get evaluated and get treated by a pelvic floor physical therapist. Now to answer this question from Steph, she's 42. She had her last baby 2 years ago and still runs to the bathroom 5 times a night and she's perimenopausal and what can she do? So getting up 5 times a night is not normal. You should be around 55, 60, you might wake up once at night to urinate. But before that, you really should be able to sleep through the night unless you're drinking a ton of fluids right before bed, in which case, you know, naturally you're going to have to wake up. But most people should be able to sleep through the night. So this is abnormal. Also, if you're going more than 8 times a day, these things are actually not normal. And so if they're not bothering you, it's fine. But waking up 5 times a night, you can imagine really affects your sleep, your quality of your life the next day. And so what can you do about it? So first and foremost, get evaluated. Make sure there is not a true cause for the overactive bladder that we can identify. So commonly in women, we'll see elevated pelvic floor tone or tension in the pelvic floor muscles. You may see if you've had any sort of surgery before that maybe it can cause some blockage of the urinary flow, which can then cause the bladder to be overactive. So those are sort of the things that we very commonly will rule out. Also make sure you're not having a bladder infection or you don't have any stones in the bladder. Other things, again, these are rare things, but just to make sure that there's nothing else that's causing these issues. And then if we've said everything else is normal, there's a whole host of things you can do in terms of natural things. Again, as Dr. Reardon mentioned, you don't want to drink too little because it gets your bladder, you're getting concentrated urine in the bladder, and that's actually a bladder irritant and it will make you go more often. So you want to drink enough. So I tell people, drink whatever you want, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and then sip on water. Don't like drink these big, like huge gulps, but like sip on a bottle of water throughout the day. And that's usually sufficient to get all your fluids because you're eating foods like fruits and vegetables that also have fluid in them. And so on average, the average American gets about 3 cups of fluids through food. And so you're getting enough. And especially if you're not thirsty, you're probably getting enough. And also you don't want to overdrink. So if you are someone having these issues and you're drinking like a gallon of water because your trainer told you to, well, you know, you got to cut back, right? Like that's, I wish that we could all drink a gallon of water, but we can't, right? And I say the big rule of thumb is like, look at the color of your urine. If it's like lemonade, you're good. If it's like clear, like water, it's too, you're drinking too much. If it's dark yellow, you're drinking too little. And so your body does a good way to regulate your fluid intake by changing the color of your urine. The other thing is avoiding bladder irritants. So we are a highly caffeinated society. I've got my coffee with me, right? And if you're drinking a lot of caffeine, that will irritate your bladder. And yes, maybe 10 years ago, caffeine didn't bother you, but you're a changing human being as you age. And so caffeine can irritate the bladder. I don't tell people you have to quit all caffeine. I say at least try. Try to go off of it for a couple days, maybe drink decaf, maybe drink half caf, and see if it makes a difference. Because some people do get habituated or get used to the amount of caffeine they drink, it doesn't add too much problem. And then same thing with acidic fruits and vegetables. Those things can sometimes irritate people. Alcohol is another one that can irritate bladders, as well as, again, these are for some people, spicy foods, artificial sweeteners, and tomato-based products. Again, don't get rid of everything in your diet, but just maybe experiment with one or two things at a time and see if it makes a difference. And if not, keep having it. Totally fine, because everyone's a little bit different. Constipation, we've talked about a lot, but a huge issue, constipation. Weight loss can help if you're overweight. That's actually been shown to improve 8% weight loss has been shown to improve urinary symptoms quite significantly. And don't smoke. So if you're smoking, quit smoking. That's going to make it worse. And so those are the easy things you can do at home. And if you are still having struggles with them, then, you know, there's other options. There's medications we have that we can try, and there's procedures that we have as well. So see a doctor if you are really struggling because we have a lot to offer.
Yeah, I agree with all of those things. And I actually see this a lot with postpartum moms. And I think what happens is during pregnancy, we start going to the bathroom more frequently. And then we have a baby and we're up in the middle of the night 4 or 5 times. And every time we wake up, we go pee. And then even when the baby's waking up less, it's like we're still waking up to go pee because we've almost trained our bladder to go that frequently. And so there is a little bit of bladder training that I kind of have people do. And the good news is the bladder is really easy to train. It's a muscle. And so some of the things I recommend, similar to Dr. Malik, are front load your fluids, you know, try to have more in the morning. I think sometimes as moms, we're not drinking during the day. And then it gets to be like 5 to 8 o'clock at night. And we're just like chugging water because we haven't drank all day. So try to front load your fluids earlier in the day, sip water throughout the day, and then actually cut your fluids off an hour or two before bedtime. If you're not going every so often during the daytime, it lets me know that this is probably a little bit more of a nighttime habit than it is like a daytime urgency. I'm going every hour during the day. So some of the things I actually tell people do, there's a lot of techniques we can do to suppress the urge at nighttime to train the bladder to chill out. So your pelvic floor muscles and your bladder work in opposite. So when your bladder's filling, it's like, hey, I gotta go. And it starts sending this signal to your brain that's like, hey, I'm getting full. And in order to kind of quiet that signal a little bit, your pelvic floor muscles tighten up. And those pelvic floor muscles tell the bladder, chill out, bladder. I know you're getting full, but I'm going to keep everything in. I'm going to keep that urine in until we can get to the bathroom at a better time. And it kind of quiets that urge a little bit. And then the bladder starts getting really, really full. And it's like, hey, I gotta go. I'm getting really full. And then the muscles kind of communicate and tighten up again. And then they say, all right, let's get going. And then those strong coordinated pelvic floor muscles can hold that urine in, tell the bladder to chill out until you get to the restroom. And then the muscles relax, the pelvic floor muscles relax. And then the bladder, which is a muscle again, starts contracting to empty the urine out. So what can happen is that if these muscles are not coordinated or strong or turning on when you need them to, they're not telling the bladder to chill out. And so some of the things I tell people, one, I think we didn't mention, if you know you're perimenopausal, check with a medical provider because you may need to start taking topical estrogen. It sounds like you might. Two is that, you know, work your pelvic floor muscles so that one, they're coordinated and strong, not tight, intense, but two, that you do some Kegel contractions to tell the bladder to chill out. So I tell people, lie in bed, take five, you know, big deep belly breaths to help relax the pelvic floor, and then do five or six Kegel contractions and really kind of tighten your pelvic floor and see if that can kind of communicate to your bladder to relax a little bit. And then if you can buy yourself 15 more minutes, okay, is the urge gone? Okay, I'm going to try to go back to sleep. Okay, it's still there. Okay, let me try that again and see if I can buy myself 15 more minutes. We're ultimately just trying to train the bladder to get to a little bit fuller so that you don't have to go all the time. So breathing, pelvic floor contractions, distraction techniques. If this is happening while you're still awake, turn on your phone, read a book, do a meditation, whatever you can do to get your mind off of, I gotta go. And you'll actually find that the urge goes away sometimes. So try to space those out during the nighttime. You know, you're just looking for longer ranges in between. And then eventually your bladder will start to kind of be like, okay, I can go every 3 hours or every 4 hours and not have to go so often. But it's exhausting. And I definitely think that the urge suppression techniques can be one part of it, the fluid management, but also there are medications that can help as well, because with a 2-year-old, you're exhausted and you got to get some rest. So I think you can still utilize those strategies even with medication. So kind of think and try some of those techniques and see if that's helpful.
Absolutely. I think that was so great. I think we've answered all the questions. And so, guys, I really want to thank you for joining us this morning or afternoon, depending on where you are in the world. Really appreciate you and hope you guys have a wonderful day. And if you have questions, leave them in the comments and wherever this gets posted. We can't wait to read them.
Yeah, thank you. And just, you know, reminder, follow Dr. Malik. She's on YouTube, social media, starting a podcast. So she's got a ton of information. I absolutely recommend that you check it out. She's located in Southern California. And then I am online. I have a whole exercise platform called The Vagina Whisper. So thevaginawhisper.com. I have tons of blog posts, tons of free content. And then I also have an online on-demand exercise program where you can really start learning how to do Kegels properly or how to relax your muscles if you have tension. And then you can check it out free for 7 days. So thank you all for joining us. Thank you, Perry, for having us. Thank you for submitting your questions. And let's go have a really great day. Thank you, everyone. Take care.
Bye, guys.
Bye, y'all.
Thank you for listening to our Perimenopause What the F podcast. The perimenopause journey can be lonely, and it doesn't have to be that way. Make sure to download our free Peri app to connect with perimenopause warriors in the same stage of life. See you next time, Peri sisters.